firmly using my family's nickname for me after the Zulu King. Black people must own their things. She bought her cars with cash, brand new out the showroom. You should see the look on those white people's faces when they ask me how do I want to pay, and I say cash. Pull out a bag full of money, and they start treating me very differently. Never put all your money in one bank, Grandma said, showing me bank deposit booklets, each from a different bank, adding up to a couple of $1 million. She taught me not to touch my money once I had millions like she did. Do you see all this money I have in these books? I get thousands of dollars in interest payments every month, she explained. I can either deposit the interest and increase my accounts every month, or I can live off the interest and use it to pay my bills, but I'll never go broke. Grandma's was very rich at that time. She wasn't supporting my mother and father financially. We were struggling to survive, but she did make sure her only grandson, me, was well educated. At Woodmere Academy, I got the best education that part of Long Island had to offer. On the bus ride after school, I was the last one dropped off, so I'd stare at the spacious mansions that the white kids went home to, watching the neighborhood become worse and worse the closer we got to my house. And I'd go home to Lakeview, back to all the blackness. I learned a couple of things at that school. I found out that white girls were real aggressive when they liked you, and that little white boys had credit cards. On weekends at my grandparents' house in Hempstead, my grandfather, Big Bud, worked on sheet music in his room while watching baseball on his small TV. The walls of his room were covered with posters from tours in Russia, Japan, all over the world. Besides baseball and jazz, Grandpops had a passion for golf. He bought me a mini plastic play school golf set and tried teaching me on the lawn. He also bought me a small saxophone and signed me up for Woodmere Academy's band. But as hard as Grandpops and I tried, I couldn't even handle Mary Had a Little Lamb. That year, my whole family came to see me play at the band concert in the school auditorium. There were 5 saxophonists on stage, including myself. You were so good, my folks encouraged me after the show. You sounded great. If they only knew I was only pretending to play, I thought, keeping it to myself. My horn wasn't blowing a damn thing, but I played it off because my grandfather was proud. My 2 best friends were Carrie, who lived on the same corner as my grandmother's Hempstead house, and Stobo, who was like a brother. We were 2 months apart in age and had known each other since birth. We called each other cousins. Even cut our hands and rubbed our palms together to become blood brothers. When Carrie and Stobo slept over, Grandpops always came home drunk from his shows and took out his false teeth, smiling and chasing us around the house. It was a scary sight for a kid. Grandmoms would get pissed at him for being so drunk and loud. Go to hell, you jackass, she'd yell after him as we scampered by. My father took me to see my grandfather perform at the Blue Note in Manhattan. I was the only little kid in the bar. But it was nothing new, because Pops was a heavy drinker and liked taking me along. As always, I ordered my favorite drink, 7-Up with cherry syrup and a couple of cherries on the rocks. And my Pops would order his, peach snaps. People would stare as if to say, how you got this little kid in a bar? But nobody messed with my Pops. Grandpops played the sax like a madman, and the Blue Note crowd loved it. After Grandpop's shows or Grandmom's dance concerts, our tradition was to eat a big meal at a swanky restaurant and for me to order the same dish, lobster tails. It was usually the most expensive thing on the menu, and I never actually ate it. Just dip my bread into the butter. But Grandmom's got a kick out of me ordering it. My grandparents usually brought one of their famous friends to dine with us. like Ben Vereen, the dancer actor from the movie Roots. He was Grandmom's student when he was a kid. Or Grandpops would bring Dizzy Gillespie or other famous jazz friends. And they all enjoyed the look on the waiter's face when I ordered first and chose the lobster tails with melted butter. My grandparents were from an era of vicious racism and poverty, so my grandmother especially loved to show off and let white people know she had money. One dreary winter evening, my mother, father, and I were at home watching Buck Rogers on TV when we got a phone call from the Nassau County Emergency Room. Grandmoms had been hit by a car while crossing Hempstead Turnpike, leaving A&S department store. A hit and run. We rushed to the hospital. The doctor said she was paralyzed from the waist down and would never walk again. Miss Bernice Johnson, the queen of dance, paralyzed? Grandmoms came home in a wheelchair a few weeks later. I didn't see her down or depressed one time. Doctors don't know shit. I could walk if I try hard enough, she said. She came from a family of tough southern women. I don't believe in can't. After about a year, Grandmoms was walking on crutches. And the following year, she was teaching classes, moving and kicking without assistance. Grandmoms' annual concert at Lincoln Center was a major event that year, her big comeback. Stobo and I ran around Lincoln Center every year like it was our personal amusement park, sneaking into the balcony box seats. Cousin Craig dared us to climb up the catwalk to the lights in the rafters. We loved peeking at the women and girls changing costumes backstage. Our favorite was Tina Douglas, R&B singer Ashanti's mother. Ashanti, who wasn't even born yet, would soon grow up in my grandmom's school, too. Tina was fine as hell. Dark brown skin with a fat ass, big breasts, and green eyes, decked out in Gucci boots and bags. She made us want to grow up fast. A few of the ladies would bend over and stretch, secretly knowing that Stobo and I were watching. At the end of the show, grandmoms came out to thank the Lincoln Center crowd while Ben Vereen clapped on stage behind her. The audience gave her a standing ovation. After the show, you already know what it was. Lobster tails with hot butter sauce, of course. When I was 6 years old, moms and grandmoms enrolled me into dance school classes. They decided it was a good way to keep me healthy because with sickle cell, the body needs light exercise to allow the blood to properly circulate. I enjoyed the classes, but I never understood why moms and grandmoms and everyone else there was so passionate about that type of dancing. To me, it was boring and corny. The only thing I liked about it was my boy Stobo was there too, and being around all those girls. Tap dancing was my favorite class. One of Grandma's close friends was an old school tap dancer named Sandman Sims. He had this routine in which he'd sprinkle some sand on the floor, and when he tap danced on it, it made a unique crunching sound under his shoes, like the sand was a part of the beat. I was amazed. What I loved most about the dance school was that my grandmother owned it. Stobo and I ran amok in that place. It was our clubhouse. Plus Jamaica Avenue, the major Queens shopping area, was right outside. What more could a young devious mind ask for? On my 7th birthday, my pops pulled out a shiny nickel-plated 380 in my Uncle Eddie's basement. Pops always told me that Eddie was a punk because he didn't bust his gun when they had beef with somebody over Eddie's sister. I'm gonna teach you how to shoot a gun, Pops said. I was shook. I did what he told me. Pops put a small garbage can across the room to use as a target. He put the gun in my hand, warning me that the gunshot was going to be very loud when I squeezed that trigger. I calmed myself down. Finally, I fired my first shot. The first shot was stupid loud and scared me so bad I jumped way back. For the second shot, I held the gun with my right hand, tilted my head, covering my right ear with my right shoulder, put my left hand over my left ear, and shot at the can again. Pops is really crazy. I think he just had me shooting to scare Eddie. We shot at that can for a couple hours, then we went home. Around that same time, Pops came home with a big BB rifle. We'd practice shooting birds up in the trees in our yard and at the park across the street from our house in Lakeview. After a week, the whole park was full of dead birds. Gross. I guess Pops was trying to make sure his son wasn't no punk because of sickle cell. That's why Pops was teaching me all this stuff. He was very intelligent, but as smart as he was, he must have had some type of criminal gene in his DNA. Yeah, he was a very wild boy who got into a lot of fights with the hands and the guns. Pops was one gun-happy motherfucker. Mom's got a job working for the New York City Housing Authority, helping people get apartments in the projects. Every 2 years, she was transferred to work in a different project. During the summer, she brought me to work with her, and I played in the playground of whatever hood she was working in. Harlem, Brooklyn, Queens. But the best was when they transferred moms to Queensbridge Projects. She worked there for 6 years. It was the summer of 1982. I was 8, and moms enrolled me into Reach Day Camp. Mom's office was on the infamous hill in Queensbridge, and the camp was across the street. Almost all the kids in QB went to Reese because it was right in the projects. I loved it because of the girls. QB had some real pretty girls. But when 5 o'clock hit, we'd be back on the Long Island Railroad, back to Lakeview. Even though Moms toured the world with hit records, you know the music biz. After all the filet mignon, champagne, caviar, and limo rides, she never got the money she was owed. We were on welfare and food stamps until Mom got the housing authority job. But no matter what, Mom's always kept a positive attitude and a kind heart. Maybe that's why Pops thought he can get away with murder. One evening, when we came back from QB, Mom's found Pops' heroin works hidden in a cosmetics bag. Needles, syringes, spoons, cotton balls, tourniquet. They argued back and forth. He left and didn't come back home for months. When he did come back, Moms made his ass sleep on the couch. When I was 8, Pops took me for a ride and told me about how he'd been addicted to heroin since he was 14 and that he and Moms might split up. No kid wants to see a parent split up. But Pops explained it in a way that made sense. Then we pulled up to a jewelry store. "Wait in the car," Pops told me. "I'll be right back." 5 minutes later, he came running out with a big brown shopping bag full of gold and all types of jewels. This fool just robbed the spot. We got 4 blocks away, and the Nassau County police were immediately on our ass. After a high-speed chase through Hempstead, Pops finally came to his senses and stopped the car. They put me in the back seat with him. Pops had the cuffs on behind his back, and I held his hand all the way to the precinct. The cops gave me chips and soda while I waited for Moms to pick me up. She went buck stupid on Pops after that, screaming and yelling, "How could you do this? That's our son, our little boy." My grandma's bailed him out 7 hours later, and he and Mom separated permanently. When he came home later that night, though, we finished our conversation from earlier in the car. My pops was a cool, calm nigga, chilling, like what happened earlier was nothing. I loved that motherfucker. The next day, Moms and I were back in QB. She dropped me off at camp, then went to work. Reese was empty that morning. Only the counselor and 3 other kids were there. 2 of them were girls. The best-looking girl walked over to me and asked me if I was new to the hood. We walked away to the card tables right outside the door. She made it real easy for a little 8-year-old without much game because she did all the talking. Meanwhile, the girl's boyfriend and seven of his friends walked up behind me. She was quiet all of a sudden. Just as I started getting into the conversation, a hand grabbed my neck from behind and turned me around. "What you think you doing?" her boyfriend barked. He grabbed my face and pushed me up against the wall to let me know I was talking to his girlfriend. "I'm new here. I ain't know it was your girl," I told him. "Better watch yourself," the kid warned as he and his boys walked off. I went back in the building. I was really about to start kicking it to Shorty, I thought, embarrassed and mad as hell. But I'm happy I ain't get jumped. It's funny how life works, because I ended up being cool with that kid, Deaky, like 10 years later. He never remembered that day when I brought it up. Later that day, they took us to free lunch at a school on 21st Street. Free lunch was disgusting. I found maggots at the bottom of my salad on a cardboard tray the first day. I never ate there again, but they still made us go. Sometimes we got on a yellow bus for free lunch at another school in Astoria, Queens. I carried a pocket knife that came in handy one afternoon. On the bus to Astoria free lunch, a big fight with 4x4s and bottles broke out with kids from another hood. The kids tried to run inside our bus and beat people up. I started swinging my pocket knife. I had them niggas shook. It was rough for a little kid, man. Something was bound to go down at free lunch in QB or the locker room in Astoria Pool. I ain't never telling moms, because I know she won't let me go anymore. I kept all the crazy stuff to myself. A popular thing with the kids in Queensbridge was making rock shooters out of quarter water bottle tops. When I first came around, I would see kids shooting rocks out of them shits. And if one of those rocks hit you, it felt worse than getting shot with a CO2-powered BB gun. I quickly learned how to make one, because all the kids were carrying them around like guns. First, you buy a quarter water and a pack of balloons. Drink the juice, and after it's empty, take a knife or razor and cut the top of the bottle off. Put the balloon over the top part that you drink from. After that, all you need is a pocket full of small rocks or pennies. Drop a rock or penny in, pull the balloon back, let go. Man, that shit will go through a windshield if you do it right. We used to have ill shootouts, 20 kids against 20 kids. Queensbridge didn't have concrete pavement back then. It was all dirt paths and hills. The projects were being rebuilt with basketball courts, fences, and playgrounds. On the block after day camp, I'd listen to the older dudes freestyle back and forth. I wrote my first song, "Use a Crackhead," when I was 9. I heard one of the older dudes rapping about crackhead, so I made my own version. My mom's brother and friends in QB told me it was good and gassed me up. That was the beginning of my road to the riches, the moment that I first started rapping. A Broadway show, The Tap Dance Kid, needed a little boy to play the starring role. My grandmoms had major connections in that world. She gave the producers photographs of me, and they called saying they wanted me to be the new Tap Dance Kid. Grandmoms explained that the casting people were on the phone and they wanted me to be the star. She told me I'd be famous and make a lot of money, but that it would be very hard work and I'd have to perform 2 shows every night. I was stuck. I was scared. Plus, I wasn't even really into dancing. I thought about it for 5 minutes and told her, "No, thank you." For the next 10 years, grandmoms kept telling everybody I turned down the starring role of a major Broadway musical. The kid who wound up getting the part was Alfonso Ribeiro. He appeared in a Pepsi commercial with Michael Jackson after that and became a TV star on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Hey, I guess Alfonso owes me. I did him a huge favor. Sometimes I think, what if? Nah. In 1983, near to when the movie Breaking came out, Grandma's talked me into performing at our annual concert at Lincoln Center. I've been taking her dance classes since I was 6. But at age 9, breakdancing and rap music were my new thing, and I wanted to stop the other dance stuff. I was at that age where I wanted to be cool. Stobo and I would be outside the crib in Hempstead with a flattened cardboard box and a radio battling 2 other kids on my block. We wore gray nylon windbreak outfits, white gloves, trucker hats with Playboy bunnies on it. We thought we was breakdance masters. I asked my grandmother to let us do a breakdance routine at our next concert.
Only if you both perform the regular dance classes at the show, she told me.
We agreed. It was a small price to pay, and was the first time my grandmom's incorporated a hip-hop routine in her concert.
We killed it, along with the tap and African and ballet, all that.
She thought it was cute to have a little grandson dancing in her school, but Stobo and I were quickly growing out of it. I can't front. Dance school was fun when we were younger. An older girl named Kerry hooked Stobo and I up with these twins, Renee and Michelle. 2 fly-ass, light-skinned West Indian shorties. They were in all our classes. Stobo had Michelle, and I had Renee. We all had fun. Grandma's was cool with the singer-actress Diana Ross, who enrolled her daughter, Chutney, at the school. My grandmother told Diana that Chutney couldn't pull up in limos or Bentleys because it would make too much of a scene. They agreed it would be better for her to arrive in a regular car. Chutney was real cute. She was the same age and in class with Stobo and me. When the word got around that Diana Ross's daughter was taking class, Kerry pulled me into the hallway, offering all kinds of ways that I should approach her and get her to be my girlfriend.
Chaka, I'm telling you, you gotta get her, Kerry said. Forget about Renee. Chutney's rich.
Kerry tried her best, but it never happened. Chutney was there for 6 months, and she got tired of all the attention. Diana Ross was doing a huge concert at Central Park in Manhattan on July 21st, 1983. My grandmother provided her with backup dancers, and my father helped with the stage production. Diana asked me to join her on stage because she thought I was cute.
I want you to walk out with me at the end of the show and say goodnight, she told me during rehearsals. Do you want to do it?
Yes. On the night of the show, there was lightning and thunder and then buckets of rain. The lawn was a blanket of deep, muddy patches, but it was summertime in Central Park, so the crowd wasn't concerned. They came to see Diana Ross. It was packed. She performed soaked, and you know black women and their hair in the rain don't mix. Well, Diana didn't care. The production people told me to get ready to get on stage. I was petrified and changed my mind. My moms, pops, and grandmoms tried to convince me, but I said no. That was the first and the last time I caught a case of stage fright. Our feet got stuck in the mud on the way out the park. My sneaker came off in the sludge, and so did my mother's shoes. No lobster tails that night, just our tails in the shower. On October 20th, 1984, Moms got a phone call from my grandmother saying that my grandfather had a heart attack and died in his sleep in a hotel room in Kansas City while he was on tour. He was 73. The entire jazz community came out for his wake 5 days later at St. Peter's Church on 54th Street and Lexington Avenue in Manhattan. Minister Reverend Genzel, who was also a jazz musician, helped make it all possible. My father was on the run from his jewelry store case, laying low, so he couldn't make it. I know that hurt him. The service was like a party with a lot of sad faces. I walked up to Grandpop's open casket and stared at him. My boy Stobo was with me. I leaned over and kissed Grandpop's on the forehead. It was ice cold. That was the first and the last time I touched a dead body. While Stobo and I were staring at him, it felt like Grandpops might sit up and do the scary face with his teeth in hand. After the service, his body was cremated and his ashes spread out into the ocean. Pops kidnapped me that same year and took me to Detroit, where he'd been staying since he and Mom split. I went over to my grandmom's in Hempstead and Pops was waiting for me. He didn't take me by force. He just didn't tell Mom's where we were going. I guess he missed me and decided to take his son. I think Pops also wanted to show me how he was living there, because his cousin Beverly had this nigga bawling. She had her own investment firm in Detroit and gave Pops a high-ranking position. Pops was wearing these fly-ass three-piece suits without the necktie. He was open off his new whip, a 5-speed Renault he had shipped from France. Beverly was richer than a motherfucker. In downtown Detroit, there was a skyscraper with her name on it. We lived in the finished part of a mansion she was having built. Beverly's son, Eric, was around 18, and her daughter, Cecily, was 12, 2 years older than me. Their backyard had a river where we went fishing for crawfish. Man, we were in Detroit living a life. I think Pops waited almost 4 months before he called Mom's and told her where we were. She knew Pops had me. She just didn't know where. She threatened to call the cops, but I lived in Detroit for more than a year. Mom's probably didn't want to upset me because I was happy to be with Pop's crazy ass anyway. Plus, Cecily and I had a crush on each other. The term kissing cousins comes to mind. I found out Pops and Beverly had a little something going on themselves. No wonder he was an overnight success. We went to Detroit Tigers baseball games a lot. I enjoyed the popcorn and hot dogs more than the baseball. Pops took me to see Scarface, starring Al Pacino, on opening night. Now that was a fucking movie. Those three-piece suits without the necktie that Pops was wearing almost looked exactly like the ones Tony Montana had on. I guess that was the style. Cousin Cecily was a very pretty, dark brown-skinned girl. She grew up with a lot of money, but was a down-to-earth tomboy. She made her own experimental facial cream products out of mud, perfume, and all types of weird stuff, using me as a guinea pig, putting crap all over my face. She was like a white girl compared to the black girls I was used to back home. She spoke like a white girl and introduced me to rock and roll music. The J. Giles band, Centerfold, Cecily's favorite song, constantly played on her little 45 portable record player. She taught me how to eat artichokes, watch WWF wrestling, and speak Detroit. Like instead of saying soda, they say pop. Then all of a sudden, the ride was over. Mom's threats of calling the police worked, and Pops agreed to send me back home. I was back in New York, except we weren't in Lakeview anymore. Mom's had moved to Lefrak City, Queens. Pops wound up coming back to New York, too. Got caught by the police and ended up doing a year in Nassau County Jail for the jewelry store thing. Once his bid was over, he moved back into the house in Lakeview with his new woman, Rita, and her teenage kids, Leon and Loretta. I wanted to be with my pops, so Mom's allowed me to stay with him and go to school over there for a while. I walked to Howard T. Herbert Middle School, cutting through the woods and crossing a construction landfill with my next-door neighbors Angel and Ronaldo. In Lakeview, I had only a handful of friends. Angel and Ray, Todd, and my man Shamik. Shamik had all the cool shit.